call 1320, 125 CV, 126 CV, and 127 CV. Dr. Lalitha Madhav Janaki?
Yes, ma'am.
D.H. Wilkinson Physician Network, DBA Christus Physician Group.
Thank you. Again, I want to just reiterate what a privilege it is to stand before the 13th Court of Appeals. Once again, it's been a while for me.
We're happy to have you.
It's equally a privilege to come before you representing Dr. Lalitha Janaki, a radiation oncologist who has diagnosed and aided to the care of the most critically ill of the residents of Nueces County for the past 35 years. It's important to point out at the outset that the issues that we're presenting in this appeal are perhaps unlike many of the dozens of employment discrimination cases that have historically come before this court. Dr. Janaki sued for whistleblowing under Section 161.134 of the Health and Safety Code. Now, that's certainly just a number, but in pertinent part, it states that a hospital cannot terminate an employee for reporting a violation of law. So what's different about this appeal at the outset is we never reach the underlying statutory violation of Dr. Janaki's allegations regarding the statute in question. We never got that far. Medicare fraud is serious, and Ms. Dr. Janaki deserves a day in court, and I'm here to tell you why. The question presented is whether or not the single integrated enterprise theory applies to the health and safety code, applies to the health and safety code violation. As I frame my argument this morning, I want to draw by analytical argument. I want to draw upon the words of some words that have resonated with me for the tenure of my career. The words of the late Judge Norman Black, who many of you know presided over the Southern District of Texas on the federal side as a chief judge for many years. He was noted for saying many things in the courtroom during hearings, but the one that resonates with me, particularly as it involves the disposition of this case on appeal, is just because we have always done something some way doesn't mean it's right. Consequently, or conversely, just because we have never done something doesn't mean it's wrong. Where I'm getting at is that there is not going to be any disagreement today between me and my colleagues representing the appellees on the application of the single integrated enterprise theory here. None of us is going to find law either way as to the applicability of this particular whistleblower statute. It just hasn't happened. Dr. Janaki's position is that everything about the theory and its intent, the theory of the single integrated enterprise theory, demonstrate that all of the appellees fall into the parameters of a single integrated enterprise. And in this argument, I'm going to show you why. Primarily, I'd like to call, and I'm not doing a share screen this morning, but I'm only going to talk about two or three documents in a record. I think I can easily cite to them. But primarily, I want to call to the court's attention, clerk's record document number 116, which is a letter from the Christus Physicians Group Counsel, her name was Leah Domstead, to Dr. Janaki's previous attorney. It's actually an exhibit that was part of the appellee's motion for summary judgment. And I, in my view, I think it's potentially the most instructive piece of evidence in the record. The letter clearly confirms the hospital's role in Dr. Janaki's termination. It no longer wanted Dr. Janaki to perform services under the contract in place between the two entities, the physician staffing service and the hospital. It shows their role in the termination. Ironically, as the record is waded through, and this again is their summary judgment evidence, we're going to see the affidavit of a human resources professional named Ms. Acuna, A-C-U-N-A, and that's the document 105 in the clerk's record. All of these are appendices to their motion for summary judgment. You're going to notice, and this is critical for the disposition of this case, an inherent conflict of evidence which appears in the evidence they presented. So despite, I'm going to elaborate, despite offering Mr. Domstead's letter, Ms. Akita, in the same summary judgment motion, contradicts it by stating in her affidavit that the hospital did not control or direct Dr. Janaki. So here we have their evidence saying the hospital made the decision not to terminate or to end the employment, and they're saying that the hospital had nothing to do with it. And I think that's critical for the disposition of the case and why I'm going to argue at the end that this case needs to be remanded on a factual issue regarding single integrated enterprise.
But counsel, isn't this hospital or this defendant prohibited by law from employing physicians? So how can they possibly be considered an employer by statute?
That's exactly what the single integrated enterprise is designed to do. You can't get around a statute by shirking out responsibility like that. It's a co-employer theory. It's a question, Your Honor, of control. Where yes, they're, as you observed, prohibited, but you can't circumvent around liability when you're going to do something in violation of a statute. You can't shirk the responsibility to say, well, we're just not the employer, because you look at the, again, the single integrated enterprise aspect of it, all the commonality between all these entities. So maybe, and not maybe, technically they can't do it, but in actuality, they are. By exercising the right of control.
Counsel, Mr. Rosenberg, go ahead, Judge.
I guess the question that I have is under Section 161.135, the Health and Safety Code prohibits hospitals from retaliating against non-employees who report a violation of law. Why would you not proceed under this statute as an alternative theory or just as your primary theory? And that would, by enacting this retaliation provision for non-employers, isn't the legislature implicitly acknowledging that hospitals such as appellees do not employ physicians, but you still have a remedy by proceeding under 161.135?
Well, obviously we didn't. I mean, that's clear in the record. I would argue two things. Number one, the liberal construction of the statute would say we did that already by bringing this case and arguing this theory of liability. And I think that's permanent. I'm not gonna, you caught it, and we know it was not done. We were just so strong on the letter that was presented that if you liberally construe how we pled the case, it's the same result. You have the retaliation. And if we didn't cite the second statute, certainly the liberal construction of our pleading would incorporate the question you just asked. I'm not here to grade the court's questions. It's a question that would concern anybody, but I think I just explained why I'm not going to trivialize it by saying it's a non-issue, because it is an issue. You wouldn't have brought it up if it wasn't, but I think it's almost a distinction without a difference, if I may.
Mr. Rosenberg, so I was going to have the same question about this particular section. So that, in essence, would be applicable to the hospitals, appellees in this case, but it does not apply to C.H. Wilkinson, because C.H. Wilkinson is not a hospital, mental health facility, or treatment facility. So assuming we get with that interpretation saying, 135 is really what applies here, that's the claim against the hospitals, what would the remedy be against C.H. Wilkinson?
Well,
any other remedy for this doctor?
So the question, if I understand it correctly, is what would the remedy be for Dr. Janaki against the physicians groups if there's liability established at the hospital? I'm not sure anything, and I'm not sure it really matters in this case, Your Honor, because I think we have proven, or at least presented evidence, that it is essentially one entity. They're technically not a hospital. They don't do hospital functions, and they're not licensed as a hospital. But as you could tell by, at least there's evidence to suggest that it's all one big operation in the form
But if we didn't agree with that, if let's assume for this argument, for this question, that we don't agree with that, is there any other? Pardon me.
Just repeat that one second. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Let's assume for the sake of the question that we don't agree with the single enterprise theory, integrated theory, and we're saying there really are, there have to be separate causes of action. So theoretically, against the appellees, you could go under 135 as a non-employee. Is there any other remedy out there that would be pursuable or could have been pursued against Wilkinson? Because obviously the whistleblower statute doesn't apply here. The Sabine pilot claim doesn't apply here. What other remedy is there? If not,
I don't believe there is. Okay. I don't, this is clearly a Medicare fraud whistleblower case is what it was always designed to do. It's always been the gravamen of Dr. Janacki's allegations against the what we consider to be joint employers. And that's how we have framed, as you can tell, we framed the case that way. But I think, you know, I think the point that the court just raised, Justice Ian Hosen, if we're going to go in that route, and I think it's fair game, all of these employment discrimination statutes, all of these whistleblower statutes have always been construed to advance the remedial purpose of prohibiting retaliation, protecting the whistleblower. Well, the ultimate issue in a case is or the ultimate fact in this case, is whether or not there really was Medicare fraud. Now, whether it applies to Dr. Janacki as a joint employee under my theory, or under the subpart that Justice Hinojosa referenced, I don't think that matters, but I would argue that, you know, liberally construing our pleadings would incorporate that. We in fact, you know, it's always been substance over form, and we did plead the allegations of the whistleblower complaint. We were very specific with what happened, very specific with what Dr. Janacki's role was, and very specific with the frame out of who did what, where, to whom. And I think that's a very critical point. Ultimately, we have to get to that answer.
Mr. Rosenberg, how do you respond to the appellee's argument that our interpretation, as you are suggesting, would violate the canon of statutory construction and basically go against the intent of this legislation?
Well, I don't agree with that, because the intent of the legislation was to prohibit Medicare fraud. We have to make sure, taking away the lawyers and everybody in the process, we've got to make sure the public is not disturbed by an entity committing Medicare fraud. That's the intent of the statute. They wouldn't have, I can't believe that the legislature would have incorporated this into the laws of the state of Texas if the overall goal wasn't to prohibit Medicare fraud. That's our overriding goal here, is to make sure that we don't have Medicare fraud rampant in the workplace. And Dr. Janacki complained about these billing practices, and you know, I think we've got all the requirements we need, such as temporal proximity, all of the things that we really don't get to because of the way, or haven't gotten to yet, because of the proceedings that have transpired to date in this case. But clearly the intent of the construction of the statute is very well served by a liberal interpretation, as all employment discriminations are to be liberally interpreted, and to provide relief for Dr. Janacki to come forward. I'm gonna give a minute back to the court. I know I can't save that for rebuttal unless there are any more questions, but I've addressed what I needed to in my argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice Contreras. Good morning to you all. It is my pleasure to appear before the court on behalf of Appalese, C.H. Wilkinson Physicians Network, and Christus Spahn Hospital, Corpus Christi, and Shoreline, as well as the cancer centers. And for ease of reference, I'm going to refer to C.H. Wilkinson as one entity And the hospital defendants is the other, so that there's some clarification without having to say all those names over and again. I would like to address first what I want to make certain the court, I believe, has already noted, and that is that C.H. Wilkinson was Dr. Janicki's employer. She was not an employee of the hospitals. She was employed by C.H. Wilkinson. The reason the statute, Justice Contreras, would not apply to C.H. Wilkinson is because it is not a mental, is not a hospital, a mental health facility, or a treatment facility. And the statute is specifically drafted to address those entities, as Mr. Rosenberg would say, for violations of law. He
specifically stated. Which is why I asked, if we were to separate these and say, all right, appellees were could have been properly sued under 135, what remedy then would the doctor have? And it seems like she wouldn't have one against Wilkinson.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not a labor lawyer and I'm not a plaintiff's lawyer, but I think based on plaintiff's pleadings, she did state that she had a contract with C.H. Wilkinson. So I would refer to that. To the extent plaintiff's counsel had the opportunity to look at that. I'm sure there are other claims of discrimination that he's familiar with, but again, for whatever reason, I believe any aggrieved employee of a company, of a contracted employee would have certain remedies available to them. Again, I'm not a plaintiff's lawyer and I'm not a labor lawyer, but I think it would be contractual in nature. And if not, then discrimination with filing to the EEOC. One of the questions that I believe Justice Hinojosa asked was about the employee status and the corporate practice of medicine doctrine. But first, before addressing that point, I do want to talk about what Section 161.134 does specifically state. And it says, a hospital mental health facility or treatment facility may not suspend or terminate the employment of or discipline or otherwise discriminate against an employee for reporting to the employer supervisor a violation of law, violation of the chapter, or a rule. Then, as you've pointed out, Your Honors, the appellant did not bring at the trial court level any cause of action under 135, which is for non-employees. Instead, appellant would like to, and at the trial court level, a plaintiff asked the court to apply the single integrated enterprise theory. Now, I think this court is aware, and appellant stated at the get-go of this argument, that it has never been applied in the context of Texas Health and Safety Code Section 131.134 or 135. It wouldn't have to apply to 135, right? So this would be a matter of first impression for this court to find that, yes, the trial court erred and should have applied the single integrated enterprise theory. Again, appellant concedes and does not dispute that it's never been applied, but rather that in advancing her argument that the hospital defendants were her employers because they acted in concert with C.H. Wilkinson. And because of that, I believe what appellant is arguing is they wanted to perhaps have liability apply to all three defendants, three groups of defendants, at one instance, in one pleading, under one theory. Now, when we get to that application, again, it's never been implied. So appellant's ipse dixit is just no reason to ignore the canons of statutory construction, which you, Chief Justice Contreras, noted. Here, because the statute is one that is required to conduct the analysis, the court's primary objective is to ascertain and give effect to the legislature's intent without unduly restricting or expanding the act's scope. Here, the courts must read statutes as a whole and render no part inconsistent or superfluous as a part of that interpretation. Now, because it has to be interpreted as written, the only reason we would be going down the path of single integrated enterprise theory is if the statute was ambiguous. If the statute is unambiguous, as it is here, on employee, non-employee, the rules of construction require that it be read as a whole and not its provisions in isolation. So appellant would have this court, and would ask the trial court to do the same, to ignore section 135, 161-135, and only read 161-134 in isolation. And by reading that, saying that appellant has no remedy against the hospitals who, quote, directed her termination, which we take issue with that, of course, and do not agree with that. But in any event, that is what appellant is asking the trial court to do. Again, as this court has noted, the statute completely recognizes throughout its provisions distinctions for employees and non-employees. And I would note that section 161, 134, and 135 were enacted 10 years after Trevino, and Trevino was a Title VII case, okay? Not a federal case, not a state court case. But 10 years later, this statute consistently says, repeatedly says, employees, non-employees. Why is that? Because it applies to hospitals and mental health facilities and treatment facilities where what? Physicians have to practice, right? They're granted privileges to practice. But again, as the court Justice Hinojosa stated, hospitals and like healthcare providers, like hospitals, cannot employ physicians under the corporate practice of medicine doctrine. Why is that? Because physicians have to be free to exercise their independent medical judgment. They can't be employed by a hospital that's going to direct their move as to how to prescribe a dosage of chemotherapy medication, how to prescribe certain radiology studies for a patient. That has to be a judgment that is retained by the physicians. So the legislature has this statute specifically defining what an employee and a non-employee can do, what provisions they can go under, and that is consistent with the Texas Corporate Practice of Medicine doctrine.
Counsel, let me ask you this. If it is a case of first impression, are we decide to look at this single integrated enterprise liability theory or consider it, we're not prohibited from considering federal cases, or do you think we're prohibited or not prohibited from considering federal cases in interpreting analogous statutes as persuasive authority?
Your Honor, here I think plaintiff appellant has inserted federal case law because that's where single integrated enterprise theory is derived from. I think that, of course, this court can look to other courts for interpretation of whistleblower statutes. But here, this statute is so specifically drafted. And again, plaintiff appellant has not contended that the statute itself is ambiguous. There's no ambiguity with the statute. And appellant has never said so. Merely said, we don't want you to apply. We don't want to pursue 135. We want to pursue 131 and hold all defendants negligent, liable for termination. And so, yes, this court can look to other court if it was on point, other federal case law, if it was on point. But here, this state statute is specific and unambiguous, and there's no allegation that it is otherwise. So in order to even look at Title VII cases, to look at TECRA cases, which actually specifically say we're going to look to federal law where necessary so that we can work in concert with Title VII, then here it is a state statute. It is created specifically and distinctly to apply under one instance to employees and the other to non-employees. So the question ends there. We don't need to look to federal statute because it's clear on its face. The next question I would like to address is, I think counsel for appellants said that there's a distinction without a difference as to sections 134 and 135. And I think clearly the briefing and what has been urged here today on behalf of appellees makes clear that there is a difference. The statute, it was crafted in a specific manner, and the court cannot ignore that the legislature specifically considered the industry upon which this statute was to be applied. And I think what's notable is that what appellant would have to do, or what appellant is missing, it's, or actually dismissing, is that if the single integrated enterprise theory were applied here as a matter of first impression, section 161.134 would have to be extended beyond its limits, beyond anything it states plainly and simply in the statute, in order for it to apply to the hospital defendants. And not only that, because it's the single integrated theory is as applied to all defendants, and as appellant and plaintiff has pled and argued today, not just the hospitals, but C.H. Wilkinson as well. So not only would it have to be extended as to the hospitals, it would also have to be extended to C.H. Wilkinson. And C.H. Wilkinson, a plain reading of the statute makes clear there's no way C.H. Wilkinson under 134 or 135 could be captured under the language of the statute.
Counsel, yeah. If we interpret section 161.134 and 0.135, as you argue, does that mean that a physician group or network can never be held liable for retaliation for reporting violations under the Texas Health and Safety Code?
Your Honor, that was a question that was posed in the Barron v. Cook Children's case. There, an LVN made complaints, and then she was terminated shortly thereafter. And there, the Fort Worth Court of Appeals said, and as appellees have argued here today, that because if the statute is not ambiguous, it's unambiguous, then you have to give the plain reading to it. Here in Barron, they said, you know what? The physician group doesn't meet the criteria set out. It doesn't fall under an operating hospital. It doesn't fall under a treatment facility. And specifically, they address treatment facility, and it's meant to be drug treatment facilities. And so there they held, no, that physician group doesn't. I would argue on behalf of appellees that in order for a physician group to be held liable under the statute, that exercise engaged by the Barron court should be undertaken. Does it fall within the numbered treatment facilities? And treatment facilities are defined 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. I mean, there's 11 of them, I think, of entities to which it would apply. And that's how a plaintiff could advance a theory under section 134. Is to make sure that the entity against whom they're suing and making a whistleblower claim falls under 134, those statutory definitions of what the hospital mental health facility or treatment facility are. Of course, the 135 only applies to non-employees as to the hospital. So that's a different scenario. But for 134, specifically for whistleblower, I believe, again, I'm not a labor lawyer, but I believe there would be remedies if those entities, those physician groups, were subject to Title VII or other federal statutes that are anti-discrimination statutes.
So, counsel, are you saying that if a hospital retaliated against a physician in some manner for reporting violation of the law, would the physician have a potential claim under section 161.135 of the Health and Safety Code?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think plaintiff appellant was asked that question. why didn't you bring it under 165, under 135? And I looked, because I couldn't really understand, thinking that he was maybe just, it was a gaslighting tactic. But I found in plaintiff's reply brief at the court clerk's record at 247, appellant said, even if plaintiff brought this action against the hospitals under Texas Health and Safety Code section 161-135, the totality of circumstances surrounding Dr. Janicki's employment contract with the physicians network who supplies her to work in the hospitals that are owned, the cancer centers that are owned and operated by hospitals, would still reasonably dictate that she's an employee of all three. So I think what appellant is saying there is that if they had brought it under 135, then her contract with C.H. Wilkinson would still implicate liability as to all the hospitals. Again, I do not understand the argument, but that's what was advanced in plaintiff's reply brief. So, I mean, appellant has acknowledged the existence of 135. But again, I go back to the canons of statutory construction, where you don't isolate 134 and 135. You read the entire statute together. And that's what was done in El Paso Healthcare Systems Limited versus Murphy, where the court said that all of those provisions in the statute, 131, sections 132, 33, 34, and 35, were obviously related. And so we have to read those provisions together. It's clear that the legislature intended to impose reporting obligations on employees and non-employees, distinguish between them and healthcare professionals, and only limit 134 to retaliation claims brought by employees. With regard to some of plaintiff's other assertions for application of the single integrated enterprise theory, I want the court to be aware, which I believe you are already, that the cases cited by appellants are all Title VII cases. They're all federal cases. Appellant cites to Johnson v. El Paso Pathology Group for the proposition that a physician group, going to you, Justice Silva, can be held liable as a joint employer. That's brought under Title VII in federal court. Dr. Janicki conceded that it's a Title VII claim. And Johnson is distinguishable not only because it's a Title VII claim, but because Judge Ferguson in that case from the Western District, before he became a dean, rejected the hospital's argument there about the corporate practice of medicine doctrine because it said it was basing its holding, its ruling and interpretation on the fact that it was a Title VII case. So the other point I would make about Title VII is that Title VII specifically says and uses the term individual, not an employee. Section 134 says employee, Title VII says individual, and allows a person claiming to be aggrieved to file suit. With regard then to the issues presented by appellant on appeal, appellees would state that the trial court did not err in refusing to apply the single integrated enterprise theory to section 161-134. And I think the threshold questions on appeal about whether 134 applies to C.H. Wilkinson are decidedly determined and in fact not disputed by appellant as to C.H. Wilkinson, and whether or not Dr. Janicki was an employee of the hospitals. Again, plaintiff conceded at her petition, paragraph 2.1, that she was an employee of Wilkinson and never rebutted the affidavit otherwise. And of course, a party can plead themselves out of a cause of action by their petition. So there's no reason to extend the statute, and we'd ask the court to affirm the judgment of the trial court.
Thank you, Ms. Calderon.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosenberg?
Yes, thank you. To start my rebuttal, I want to directly answer Justice Hinojosa's question regarding federal cases. I think you asked whether or not this court can look at federal cases. Ms. Calderon provided an answer. I'm going to give you the answer that's in our brief. The Supreme Court of Texas did on many cases. One of them is Chata that's cited in our brief, CHATA, which is probably the most recent one. It's actually ours internally here. There are a bunch of others, Tenney's, TOENNIES, but it's been a consistent position of the Texas Supreme Court to look at federal cases for an analytical approach. So a lot is made in counsel's argument that I'm looking at Title VII cases, and sure I am. And the reason why we are is because historically there are going to be many more or much more opinions on the federal side in interpreting how things are defined. So we did specifically cite to other employment discrimination cases because there's just a vast of material out there. And all of the cases, even Carnation Company versus Borger, which is not in our brief, it's a Texas Supreme Court case dealing with workers' comp retaliation. They talk about Title VII. It has nothing to do with it, but they talk about it. So we've been doing this in Texas for a very, very long time. So the reason why we looked at the cases we did that Ms. Calderon just cited, the Johnson El Paso case and the Williams case, is it that courts addressing liability of hospitals have given inherent nature of being involved with physicians groups and staffing agencies. So saying it differently, when we have cases involving hospitals and physicians groups and staffing agencies, we've seen courts apply the single integrated enterprise theory. That's in Johnson versus El Paso Pathology, which is one that's a multitude of cases there. Another similar case is the Williams versus EMO Behavioral, another Fifth Circuit case. We shouldn't be penalized for citing to Fifth Circuit and federal cases when, number one, the Texas Supreme Court suggests it and says that's where we go. But you're not going to get analogous facts. You're getting analogous theories, and that same exact theory was in the Johnson El Paso Pathology case. Same issue we have here. Lastly, one of the first questions, I can't remember which justice, I apologize, asked Ms. Calderon when she started presenting her argument, were there any other remedies? Were there other claims of discrimination? Was there anything else Dr. Janacki could do? And Ms. Calderon gave the answer I'd expect. She's not a labor lawyer and couldn't really answer the question, but did refer to the contract. Well, look, I am a labor. I'm board certified. I've been doing this a long time. That doesn't mean I know more than anybody else. It just means I'm old. But I could tell you the last thing any reviewing court wants to see, whether it's a district court or court of appeal, is a shotgun approach. So, yeah, Dr. Janacki falls into protected age class. She may fall into protected national origin class. She may fall into a whole bunch of protected categories. But the last thing we would ever want to do is present this court with a shotgun approach. Well, you know, if it's not whistleblower, it's got to be age. If it's not age, it's got to be national origin. We have historically in this office, in my practice, rejected all that. We plead what's there. And what's there in this case was a physician, regardless of her age, regardless of her origin, regardless of anything else, who reported Medicare fraud. There was a statute. There's a statute specifically designed to address that, specifically. So I'm asking the court to look at the intent of the statute. I'm asking for a liberal construction of what's pled. Let's say, for example, we simply pled that we just pled the statute, but not a particular subsection. Just mentioned the title of the statute. A liberal construction of that would have allowed for liability on any of the subpar theories. Certainly might have elicited a special exception and things like that, but it wouldn't have precluded us on the pleadings alone. And I would hope that this court wouldn't preclude Dr. Janacki on those pleadings when the specific purpose of the statute is to remedy a wrong.
Thank you. Any other questions, justices? All right. If not, then thank you very much for your argument today, and the case will be under submission. Have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.